This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, you're listening to The Morning Run with Lin Mark, Kusu Chuang and Wong Xiaoning. It is 7:07 in the morning, Thursday the 22nd of August, and overnight US stocks rose as strong quarterly results from retailers like Target and Lowe's lifted investor sentiment. The Dow was up 0.9%, just like the NASDAQ, and the S&P 500 was also up 0.8%.
Yeah, but in Asia though, a different picture. Fears of a global recession weighed heavy on markets. The Nikkei was down about a third of a percentage point. The Hang Seng was up 0.2%. The Shanghai comp marginally higher, slightly higher, 0.01%, which is near as nothing. The STI down 0.4%, and the KLCI, not surprisingly, also down 0.5%.
Meanwhile, all eyes are on the Fed as the market digests its July meeting minutes and await with bated breath on the signals that Chairman Jerome Powell will deliver at the Jackson Hole Symposium this week. It starts on Friday.
Indeed. And so for some more thoughts on what we will see out of Jackson Hole, we have Tony Nash on the line with us this morning. He's CEO of Complete Intelligence. Thank you for joining us, Tony. So the minutes of the FOMC July meeting have been released. Does it change the current market expectations of the three further cuts for the year?
Well, I think there's a lot more guarded view on international markets, particularly in Europe, and recession watch for Europe and the slowdown in China. So, of course, there's always the tension between the White House and the chairman. But I think there's more of an easing view, mostly as, let's say, insurance policy against a global recession.
Yeah, Tony, what will you be watching out specifically this Friday?
Well, you know, we'll really be looking for things like dissension in the ranks of the Fed. How aligned are they, and how the different speakers present their case for their view on the economy.
And Tony, if we move to China, right, investors have pulled out nearly $3 billion from funds in China's stock markets over concerns over economic growth and impending tariffs. Do you see this outflow as temporary because asset allocation into China is a must for any global portfolio?
I'm not really sure if asset allocation in China is a must. I think it's possible for investors to look at China's largest trade partners to get some of that mirroring effect. I think when we look at the growing debt profile of China and we look at the desperation behind some of the central government moves, like letting banks take on more local government debt, which is very low rated and very risky, it seems like those outflows are more, let's say, medium term. A lot of it has to do with currency risk with the devaluing Chinese yuan. And until I think you get a CNY that is below 7, meaning 6 point something, I think you'll continue to see outflows.
And Tony, the US and Japan appear to be heading towards a partial trade deal that could be finalized as early as next month, seemingly averting one of the many trade conflicts currently underway. So how important is this, do you think, for the Japanese economy, especially the auto sector?
Well, it's important for Japan, it's important for the auto sector, but we have a number of things happening. It seems we have a secular change in the auto sector with auto market growth declining in most major markets, Europe, China, U.S., Japan. So Japanese automakers have a tough time and global automakers have a tough time. But with regard to the trade agreements, yeah, of course, U.S.-Japan agreement would be very favorable for both sides, mostly because it removes uncertainty and those trading companies can price in any changes. But for Japan, because they're meeting with Korea with Korea and Beijing soon, it'll help reduce uncertainty around the Japanese trade environment generally, which is positive for those people who are investing in Japanese equities. The thing we need to remember, though, is BOJ is not going to let the yen appreciate much beyond 106 or maybe 105. Their intention is really to have a weaker yen so that they can then trade at more favorable terms.
Thank you so much, Tony. And that was Tony Nash, CEO of Complete Intelligence. And actually, I was quite interested in what he highlighted as the thing that he would be looking out for out of the Jackson Hole Symposium this Friday, which is a dissent. Because if we remember, even with the rate cut that the Fed put forward, it wasn't a unanimous decision amongst the central bankers. I think there were two central bankers who disagreed with the 25 basis point rate cut.
Yeah, it was not unanimous by any stretch of the imagination, but really it's also a test of Jerome Powell's perceived independence or lack thereof. Because if he cuts, then he will be seen to be aligned with Donald Trump's wishes. And if he doesn't, well, then he's also... So it's a little bit of he's damned if he doesn't, he's damned if he doesn't.
Well, even the Boston Fed chair says the economy is doing well enough, and he looks at the hard data points and thinks, hey, we don't need to be so aggressive with cuts, right?
But that's what you said. I mean, I heard you last week and you were saying that basically it's not a case of the American economy doing well or not. It's the rest of the world.
Yes.
Right? And can the American economy save the rest of the world? I think that's really germane at this point in time.
It's going to be difficult because if the rest of the world is in the doldrums, I mean, you can't be the only one standing strong, right? And we do see some weak data points, one of which is businesses aren't spending enough. So yes, consumers are doing their bit. We see that in the results of Target, in Lowe's. Even the consumption numbers are good. Job data is good. But businesses aren't spending. There's this sense that I'm going to hold back. I'm not really sure. It's the uncertainty that makes all investors kind of nervous, especially businesses, big corporates. They're not really spending as much as they should.
Speaking of corporates, though, taking a look at some of the international headlines, the on-again, off-again Saudi Aramco listing is apparently on again. And Goldman Sachs appears to be in contention for a piece of that pie. And this is according to the Financial Times. They report that Goldman Sachs is in the running for a role in Saudi Aramco's planned stock market listing.
Well, it depends who you talk to, right? That's the Financial Times suggesting that Goldman is in the running. But then when you look at Bloomberg reckons that Lazard and Moelis are the ones going to front-running the bid. And Lazard is basically in the picture because even though they didn't have a role in the first IPO attempt, they did have a role in the bond offering, which Saudi government raised $12 billion at a time when basically the whole world was against them for Jamal Khashoggi's death. The other players in the game include HSBC, JP Morgan and Morgan Stanley, but no mention of Goldman Sachs.
But you know, I think it's just a formal thing.
It is, right?
Because investment bankers, they don't want to be left out, right? It's like, you know, everybody's in the game, but I'm not. So, you know, die, I want to be on that list.
Well, it's a $100 billion offering.
It is the largest.
Get scraps, those scraps are worth a lot of money.
That's true. But I'm just curious how well it will do. Because this year, it's not been a very good year for the big IPOs.
Is that correct?
No, we had Uber, we had Lyft, and even the WeWork IPO that is slated for September, there's already been some rumblings of dissatisfaction
around
here.
WeWork is a bit of a duddler, if you ask me, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's a landlord masquerading as a tech company.
It is. It's not. It's like mutton disguised as lamb, isn't it? Nice from far, far from nice.
It's not a lamb chop.
It's going to be interesting to see if that even actually makes it to market, actually. But also in the international headlines this morning, the IMF has backed the scrapping of a long-standing age restriction preventing its new managing directors from being 65 years or older. And effectively what this does is that it clears the way for Bulgaria's Kristalina Georgieva to succeed Christine Lagarde.
Yeah, so this is interesting because the IMF has been a little bit ageist since 1951 when it's imposed this 65-year-old age policy. But you know what? There's a high chance that she might be nominated to the position, and she's been heavily lauded for her work in MNCs, and she's been the CEO of the World Bank for the last 2 years, and she's done a really good job. And by all accounts, she should, you know, make it past that threshold.
I think everyone's taking a leaf out of Malaysia's book.
A 65 when you got 94.
Yeah, come on, nothing.
That's 30 years, man.
Yeah, you got a long way to go, honey.
Age is just a number, after all. But the deadline for IMF hopefuls to enter the race to become a managing director closes on September 6th. So we will be watching that as we head towards that deadline. BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.